The Beer EDU Podcast, episode 115, Distance by Choice with Ryan Tibbins. Welcome to the Beer EDU Podcast, the podcast for educators that love to learn and share ideas with fellow educators over beers, with your hosts, Kyle Anderson and Ben Dixon.
What's up, Kyle?
Hey, Ben. How's it going, buddy?
I am good. Hey, if we're together, that means this is another episode of the Beer EDU Podcast, episode 115.
Yes, indeed. And we're just going to cut to the chase, do some introductions, yep, and do what we do best, and that is drink some beers before we get going. I am Kyle Anderson. You can find me on Twitter at AndersonEdTech, and you can find me on Instagram at the same handle. I have a blog, AndersonEdTech.net. And then I also am the author of To the Edge, Successes and Failures Through Risk-Taking, which you can learn more about at ToTheEdgeEDU.com. You can find it on Amazon, BarnesandNoble.com, and also through my publisher, EduMatch Publishing. And you, my friend, you are?
I am Ben Dixon. You can find me on Twitter and Instagram at BDixonNV. And since this is a Beer EDU podcast, we have beers. Kyle, I'm interested in what you have. Because you've been very cryptic about what it is.
Yeah. I think we talked about this on a previous episode that for my 40th birthday, my wife threw a party and people brought over the challenge was to bring me beer that I had never had before. So one of my coworkers that could not make it a couple days later brings me a gift bag at school and says, "Don't open this at school." Well, I found out when I
those
got home.
Those are the best.
Yes, those are the best. So I found out when I got home that it was beer, which, you know, always a nice thing. So, right. And one of the beers in it was a 16-ounce can of a beer from a company in Alpine, Wyoming called Melvin Brewing, which I have no idea where Alpine, Wyoming is. I'm going to have to look that up. And I had never heard of Melvin Brewing. And this is a beer called Huckleberry Haze. This is an India Pale Ale IPA. I'm going to assume it's hazy. And it is brewed with huckleberries, which we were talking a little bit beforehand. For those that don't know what a huckleberry is, think of it as a larger, not as sweet blueberry.
Yeah, yeah, definitely. I'm super interested in this because I'm gonna guess. I don't know. I'm guessing like probably with Citra hops with it.
Maybe. So let's see what the can says. Mosaic. So the can says that. Indigenous to higher elevations, the illustrious huckleberry is highly sought after by both human beings and bears. So if bears like them, you know, they can't be bad at all.
Can't go wrong. Man.
With refreshing notes of huckleberry, tropical fruit, citrus, and hints of strawberry, this is the IPA you've been looking for. So I have not even opened this yet, so I'm going to open it now.
There we go.
Crack of the can. There you go. Always a satisfying sound. And this is pouring nothing like what I expected. I expected a little bit of a purplish to it because of the huckleberries, but there is none of that there.
Really?
This is a pretty standard looking hazy IPA.
That's a hazy IPA.
Yep. So I'm even seeing a little bit of sediment in there a little bit. So I'm not sure if that's a good thing or a bad thing. Probably not, but we'll see. Oh, that is delightful.
All right.
Yeah, the citrus is there. There is definitely that little bit of strawberry the can said. And then I've had huckleberries before. I've had different things made from huckleberries. If you've ever been to Montana or Wyoming, you can buy a lot of stuff that are huckleberry. One of my favorite things I ever had was I had a bison brisket burger with huckleberry barbecue sauce on it. And it was really, really good. And The huckleberries in this is very, very subtle. This is, I would call this a lawnmower beer, even though it is 6.7% ABV and 33 IBU. This is really, really good.
So did you pull it up on tap?
I did. And overall, it is averaging 3.8 on the scale.
Oh, I just found it. Okay.
Yeah, there's less than 500 check-ins to this. Damn. So I'm going to assume that this is a very, very small brewery that does not.
Right.
Distribute very far. So I'm considering myself pretty lucky that I got a hold of a can of this stuff.
Nice.
You've got something that, something that's right up your alley, we'll say.
I know. So, shocker, I went with the IPA. I went with the double IPA, the DIPA. So this is Mosaic of Galaxies. It is Napa Smith Brewery. I was just in Napa and went to the store because when you get an Airbnb, you got to buy groceries and stuff, and that includes beer. So I went with this one. It is 8% ABV, 80 IBU. So it is not a lawnmower beer at all. It's got, I'm looking here, it's got citrus, mosaic, and galaxy hops. And it is a true double. I mean, it's 8%. So it is not, while it is, it's not overpowering. It's definitely, this is not a lawnmower beer. I'll just leave it at that. So yeah, it's solid. It's good.
I don't know if I've had that beer in particular, but I know I've had that brewery, and I'll tell you how I know. When we first started this show back in 2018, one of the first big events that I went to after we started the show was Fall Q, which was in American Canyon, just outside of Napa. There weren't any Q of Nevada folk there, so I had to be adopted by another affiliate at that event. So East Bay Q members like Lori Wong Roberts and many others, Maggie Elliott, they were there. They took me in as one of their own. And we met at Napa Smith Brewery in Vallejo. And I remember having beers there and then bringing some back. And I do recall featuring one of the beers on the show. I'd have to go back to our notes and look to see which one it was. But I'm glad to see that Napa Smith is still rocking good beers.
I know. And I'm like, it's a brewery I haven't been to. And actually, I think it's the first Napa Smith beer that I've had. Cause usually if I go to Napa, I mean, this was a very sad moment in my trip when we had reservations at Stone, cause Stone has a San Diego and then they have a Napa one. We got there, they had just gotten evicted from their building. Like we walked up for dinner and they're like, there were kegs in the parking lot. And I was like, what's going on? And the guys are like, we just got evicted. And I'm like, how do you get, clearly there was an issue with the landlord. I mean, it's Stone Brewery. It's not like Stone can't pay their bills. So I had to settle for something else. So, but hey, that's enough about mine. We have a guest.
And yes, absolutely. So we had a good little conversation before we even hit record. So I'm looking forward to the rest of this conversation now to pick up. So let's welcome Ryan Tibbins to the podcast. Ryan, how's it going, Ryan? Man?
Doing all right. Thank you guys for having me. This is great.
Yeah. Awesome to have you. And you have beer. You got special beer just for this show. So
I figured this was, you know, this is a win in a bunch of ways, right? I get to talk to you guys, be on your show, you know, right? And then I was like, well, this could turn into exposure for someone else. So, you know, right now we have some holidays. Yeah. You know, we had yesterday was a day off for Election Day and early Veterans Day. And and so we went up to a brewery right up the road from my house. It's about 10 minutes. It's right on top of the Blue Ridge Mountains on the border between Loudoun County and Clark County. So I teach in Loudoun. I live in Clark in sort of Northern Northwestern Virginia. And so, I mean, I'll give them the shout out because basically I was like, hey, I'm going to be on this podcast. You guys interested in throwing me a couple of beers? And so they hooked me up with two. So it's Bear Chase Brewing Company in Bluemont, Virginia. And they're only probably 2 or 3 years old, but it's beautiful. It's you got a view from the top of the mountain where they cleared all the land. And you can see, I mean, you can see all the way to the horizon. You know, on a clear day, you can see almost to D.C. to one of the towns just short of. And so initially, everybody just went because it was a cool place to hang out. And the beer was pretty good. And then it got better and it's gotten better. And they've got a huge, huge variety. So I'm drinking their Oktoberfest, which is a Marzen, which I mean, I don't know a whole lot about. It's I'd say it's lager-ish, maybe a little maltier, you know, and it. They said, well, how about you try the Oktoberfest? And I was like, is it red or amber? Cause that's the one place I don't really go. They get a little sweet. And they're like, trust me, it's good. You know? So they gave me a little taster and I said, okay, cool. But yeah, they just won a gold medal at the Great American Beer Festival for this one this year. And I think they won it maybe 2 years ago as well. So this one's like 6%, 16 IBU. It is, you guys ever had a Yingling? It's the America's old brewery.
Yes. Right?
So I grew that's up in Pennsylvania. So, yeah,
we love Yingling on this show. We just can't get it that often because
that's what I said. You guys are out west, so that's tricky.
If I'm in DC, that's my beer.
Yeah. So I grew up in Pennsylvania, and I mean, I would hesitate to say like that's a beer I grew up on because that's the wrong way to describe it. But, you know, it. I mean, where I grew up, you can walk into a bar and say, give me a pitcher of lager. Just, you know, it's like the Super Troopers, you know, a liter of cola. You say, give me a pitcher of lager and you get a pitcher of Yuengling. I feel it's kind of like that. It's a little the malt flavor is a little different, it's a little sweeter, but it's similar. So it's not bad. Yeah, they sort of sold me on that. And then they also graciously hooked me up with their Evening Sunset IPA, which is delicious. That one I have almost every time I go there, but it's 7.8%. And since, you know, I don't know how long we're talking and I still have a little work to do tonight, I didn't want to jump into that one first. So I'm going with the Oktoberfest early, and once I finish up my stuff, then we're going to the IPA later.
There we go.
Trying to be responsible.
Nice. That sounds delightful. I've never been to Virginia, and I don't know, when I hear mountains, I know the mountains out east are a little smaller than the mountains that Ben and I are used to, but sitting on top of a mountain and drinking beer sounds like a pretty good day.
It's a big hill or a very small mountain. The only way I'm okay with calling it a mountain, everyone's like, oh, you go over the mountain. And that's how we refer to it. You know, from where I live, a lot of people work east, you know, closer to DC, and they're like, oh, you have to go over the mountain. The only reason it qualifies is your ears pop as you go over the top. It's just enough that my ears pop and I go, okay, it's a mountain, barely, but it is.
Yeah. I was in Virginia for a wedding outside of, and I totally lost the name of the, it's a huge resort outside of Roanoke. It's up in the mountains in the Alleghenies.
There's a few down there. Yeah.
Yeah. It's a real old place. And it was weird. We had to drive up. The guy's like, okay, we got to go up this mountain and everything. And I'm like, okay. And it's, I mean, it was a mountain. It was weird. I mean, the mountains we have here, we have forest, but you guys have like, holy crap. Like I can't see 5 feet outside of the road because it's solid trees. So yeah, you guys have, I would qualify them as mountains.
Yeah, it's you know, the Appalachians are like the oldest mountain chain in the world. So we can't say they're not mountains, but compared to maybe what you have out west, it's a little different. But no, it's a beautiful place. And there's actually I mean, not to dwell on the local stuff too much, but over the last maybe 10 years, there've been a ton of vineyards opened up in the area. Mm-hmm. They did all these soil tests and realized, hey, you know, Northern Virginia and Central Virginia actually can grow decent wine. And as that industry got going, the state started to subsidize and like offer tax, you know, incentives to start these businesses and stuff. And people were like, well, what about breweries? And now all of a sudden, you know, we've got three really nice breweries on that mountain, all within about 10, 15 minute drive. So it's a nice little hop to run the three of them and never be more than 15 minutes from home. So it's cool.
That's awesome.
Creating jobs and creating camaraderie.
That's right. That's right. It's good for the community.
That's right. Well, once again, Ryan, thank you so much for taking some time out of your busy schedule to join us. So, now, before we get any deeper, let's talk a little bit about who you are, what you do in education, kind of your story, how you got there. So give us the Ryan Tibbins story.
Oh, man, this is going to be either wild or boring. I don't know if I can cut the middle very well. No, we'll keep it G-rated. So I'm Ryan Tibbins. I teach high school English in Loudoun County, Virginia. I teach pretty much all 11th and 12th grade and have for a long time. And this is my 16th year teaching. I ended up in Virginia because I went to James Madison University, and really teaching was almost an accident. I was an English major, and I wanted to be a writer, thought maybe about going to law school. And I had a bunch of friends from my English classes who were doing education stuff. And they're like, hey, you should just check out these classes. Like, you know, it's a good thing to fall back on. And then they're like, and there's a 50-year master's. And I was like, wait, I stay one extra year and I get a master's degree. And they're like, yeah. And I was like, well, I love college. So that's sort of what got me into it. It was just on the grounds of, I like college and this sounds like the cheapest way to stay. And you know, I didn't honestly, the classes were okay, but it was for the most part, this always sounds terrible, but I mean, if we're being honest, I stuck with it because for the most part, the classes were easy A's and they were full of cute girls. Like I was in it for all the wrong reasons initially. And then after a while, like once I got into the classroom, it's like, hey, do your first, you know, little practicum experience.
Right.
And I was like, oh man, I love this. And I got really good feedback, and I got good feedback on things that I didn't feel good about, which is where I was like, maybe I could do this. So I was like, I would teach a lesson and then, you know, you don't get to teach again for a week or 2 weeks. And I was like, man, that was awful. I could do that so much better. And then boom, like, hey, you know, great job. And I got all this positive feedback. I thought, okay, I can work with this. And by the time I was student teaching, that's when I was like, oh, hey, I actually enjoy this. I think I could be good at this. But I was basically in the classroom before I had decided that was something I was going to do. and then ended up, you know, taking a job in the state of Virginia. Just that's, you know, we had a job fair and that's sort of where I ended up. And then, you know, so I've been at two schools for, you know, 5 years and then one for 10 years. And just this year I took a job in the county's new distance learning program. So I am 100% distance learning online, working from home. But I still have like the same employer, the same expectations and all that. Just I'm in my basement. This is my classroom, you know? And so that's been sort of the path. So I do all 11th and 12th grade. I've taught both AP classes and that's it. Yeah. That's sort of how I got here, I guess.
Well, it is interesting because I was an English major, and then I was like, what do you do with an English major degree? Because I'm like, I liked school. Like, my kids make fun of me. They're all, shouldn't you be a doctor? Because you like went to school for a long, long time. And I'm like, I took all kinds of cool stuff. But yeah, it was the same kind of thing. I was like, I guess I should teach. And that was, you know, I'm actually one class short of my English degree. I ended up switching and going to elementary. For reasons I've talked about. Go ahead.
Oh no, I was just saying, I have an anthropology minor where I think I'm one, maybe two classes short of the major. And I had a professor who was like, you should stay, you should finish it. And I was like, for what? Like, no one pays you for an anthropology degree. Like, I got what I needed out of this. I learned a ton of cool stuff. This is great. But I don't, you know, so I have the minor, but I'm like one or two classes short. But yeah, my whole thing, I wanted to teach college. I was going to be a college professor, and my best college professor, shout out to Dr. Mark Facknitz. He, I wouldn't say he talked me out of it, but he gave me the realities of like what it's like to try to work in higher ed, how hard it is to get a job, et cetera, et cetera. And he basically said, he goes, you could go teach high school and figure out a way to get yourself into AP classes. And he goes, you could be doing basically what I'm doing, but you will be making money right away. And he goes, if you want to be a college professor, just imagine that you're starting your adult life when you're close to 30. And you have to fight for a job. And he goes, and in the end, it might be great. He goes, but it's going to be awful for a long time. And I'm like, oh, well, that does not sound great. And so I landed a job in high school, and I have a couple friends who are in higher ed, and every single thing he said was true.
Yeah, I'm convinced that someday I think I would like to maybe teach college courses full time, not just as an adjunct. Like, we've had guests on the show that are adjunct professors on the side from their full-time teaching gigs or whatever they may do. But same kind of deal though. It's like, do I really want to go fight for a position and then not know semester to semester if I'm going to be able to come back? You know, I have job security right now. So something that maybe down the road I'll pursue the doctorate, because that's another thing. The doctorate, it doesn't, at least in my district, there's no motivation to get a doctorate because I think the pay bump is like an extra $500 a year or something.
You lose money.
Yeah.
At least in my district, I figured it out.
Exponential amounts of money to do that. So I'll be 53 when I'm eligible to retire after 30 years. We know we're not retiring at that point. I can't, that might live another 40 years. There's no way I can retire. So maybe at that point, then I can go on.
You got to do it. That's my plan. You know, I'll hit 30 years at like 53 and a half or something. Mm-hmm. But I live like where I live. I am 10 minutes from West Virginia. So, you know, assuming all goes well, you know, whatever, I'm going to ride this out. And when I hit the first point I can retire with, you know, full benefits, I'm out, and then I'm going to work another 5 to 10 years in the state right next door. And then that way you basically bank it. Like, that is, I mean, so I'm not technically retired, but at that point I also get, you know, psychologically, I know my job is optional, you know, and knowing you don't have to be there is, I think, a really good thing, you know,
I've had a similar thought because, there's actually a town about an hour and 15 to an hour and a half from Las Vegas called Baker, California. It's in the middle of nowhere and nobody really lives there. But the handful of people that do, they obviously need schooling. So the teachers that work at the school there, they all commute from Las Vegas. They have the school district down there provides them with a van, and they all meet in the morning and then drive down there. And it's like, I could retire and then go work in Baker and make gobs of money and collect my retirement at the same time. That'd be awesome,
dude.
So that's another option.
Kyle, you have a special ed degree. It's called critical needs. Don't worry.
Oh yeah.
Don't worry.
I'm not.
You can retire and go right
about
back
not
to work in
your
district. Yeah.
Yeah. No, we've already talked. One of my coworkers recently, she taught English for 25 years, and they offered her a buyout at the age of 48 to retire and then come back in a critical needs position. She's taking the classes right now as a special for special ed endorsement or degree. but she's collecting full retirement benefits and a full paycheck with medical, dental, the whole nine right now at the age of 48. So I told her in 8 years, if that's still around, you need to tell me how to do that. So
yeah, you guys, I more power to you. Cause like I got 4 years and let me tell you, it's not going to be when I'm done, I'm gonna go work in a bike shop. I'm like, no, or I'm going to work at a brewery. There you go. That's what I'm going to do. I'm golf like, course. Nope, I'm out.
Golf course is the way to go. I haven't. Oh. I was just saying, I'm off work tomorrow. I'm going to play golf for the first time since right after my daughter was born. But I've coached high school golf. I played when I was in high school.
There you go.
But I've worked at three different courses, and that's the best. I mean, the hardest part of the job is you have to show up early, but then most places give you a free run. Like most public, I play golf anytime I want. I get discounts on all the food and stuff. I go hang out. Oh. It's just a cool place to hang out. So I've worked even while teaching. Ooh. I've done, you know, the Saturday morning shift at a local golf course. But that's part of that retirement thing. I'm like, you know, I like to keep busy. When people say, go. Oh, I'm going to retire. Oh, you know, oh, I'd be so bored. I'm like, like I'm good at keeping myself busy. No, I got 9,000 hobbies. I will fill the time productively somehow. And at least one or two of those hobbies will pay me at least something.
There you go.
So yeah, keep busy.
Awesome. So Ryan, tell us a little bit more about, like, I know lots of people are doing the distance learning thing. So, and you're doing it now, like fully, like, so like, was that like your whole district went that way and that's how you got into it? Like how did you make that switch and has it been easy? Like, how do you feel it's gone?
You know, I mean, I think like anything else we do in a public school, it works for some people and it doesn't for others, you know, and mm-hmm. one of the things that I like, you know, not necessarily about the daily job, but sort of on the philosophical level is that it presents an element of choice. You know, my podcast, I did like a series of episodes on school choice, cause I think it's a really cool idea. I just think it's a tricky one. Like it's potentially very dangerous, but it done right, it could be amazing, you know? And so this was an opportunity essentially to be involved in a choice program, still within the public system, still with the same employer. But if you had told me 2 years ago, hey, you're going to want a job doing distance learning, I would have laughed you out of the room. I'd be like, no way, you know? And there are some things I miss about the classroom, but I don't know. It was sort of time to do something new. You know, I'd been at the school I was at for 10 years. I had great, great principals and coworkers, and it was awesome. But I felt like in certain ways I was just kind of plateauing a little bit, you know, and I'd even talked to my principal who is, I mean, I would probably call him a professional mentor. I don't really think of a lot of people as like a mentor, but he's one of the very few people who where I'm like, you know, I'm thinking about doing something, like that's a guy I want to get his input, you know? Mm-hmm. And we had talked about some options. And then when the distance learning thing popped up, I said, what do you think? My concern was initially stability. Like, is this going to be around for more than a year? Cause it's so much work. It is so much work. Like if you guys did distance, like, you know, I can walk in person, I could show up, you could point at a classroom and I could walk in and teach a lesson. I've got stuff here. I'd be like, you got paper, you got a pencil, let's do it. And I will keep everyone engaged. And, you know, I can do that. You can't do that online because you can't just say, get out your pencil and paper and share it with your neighbor. Like that there is no sort of just organic random chat and whatever, like everything has to be done intentionally, which means that everything has to be pre-prepared. And so for me, I thought this was a cool opportunity to, you know, I mean, work from home was one part of it. I had a long drive. I have young kids, so it's nice to be around a little more. But more than that, it was a chance to do something that I felt like was kind of new and innovative and to push myself. But it's a lot of work. And so I talked to probably a dozen people who have, you know, insider info within the county. And this is a program they'd been talking about for a long time. They'd been, you know, it had been sort of in the works for 3, 4, 5 years. And so I think after the distance learning by necessity last year, I think they just said, you know what, it's now or never. Like, if we're going to do it, let's take the momentum. And so I said, let's do it. And as long as it lasts a few years, then I'm glad I did it. It's totally worth it. If we don't keep our funding or enrollment next year and I'm right back in the building, I'm going to lose the little bit of hair that I've left, because that would have been a very bad gamble.
Well, I'm not psychic, but it ain't going anywhere. I think the genie's out of the bottle on that one. I mean, my district, we had an online presence. We had a separate school for kids, and their enrollment, as we transitioned back to everybody back in person, like at my district, Kyle's district was fully online last year. My district was, we did like a, like, in elementary, you could be face-to-face or you had a distance learning option. So I had four teachers do DL, and my high school, our high schools were on like this random, like AB schedule thing. But I kind of want to go back to this. You made a great point, and I'm interested in Kyle's thought on this, the planning piece, because you're right. I mean, like having taught for a long time, Kyle's taught for a long time. I'm the same way. Like if I have to go sub a class, like, cause I don't have a sub, which I've had to do, I do kindergarten, but like I can get through the day. Like I can just put me in there, give me some stuff. We can figure this out. The online thing, that is like super interesting. The planning piece, like Kyle, did you feel that way too? Like the planning was just a whole next level.
Because everybody was online, not by choice, it made it obviously tough. So mm-hmm. planning lessons, especially since so many people had never done anything like that before. So I had never taught online before, but because of my background with educational technology, at least I had a toolbox to where I could start mm-hmm. doing something with it. With distance learning, emergency teaching, whatever you want to call what 2020 was, whatever, insert your description here. For me, it was about putting together a lesson, 20% content, 80% entertainment. It was essentially what it was, because I can't tell you how many times, and anybody listening right now can probably tell you the same thing, that you'd get on, whether it was Zoom, Google Meet, Microsoft Teams, whatever platform you're using,
right,
you stared at a screen of just blank black squares with an icon. Maybe it was a student's initials. Maybe it was a profile picture they uploaded, whatever it may be. And if you asked a question, you didn't get much response. If you called a student out by name, you often didn't get a response because a lot of kids, they logged in and walked away. They logged in and fell asleep, whatever it may be.
Taking naps. I got a lot of kids who are doing class in the dark these days. That,
oh, yeah. Like,
because we couldn't require cameras on before because everyone was doing it by force. And they were like,
right,
you can't require people to show you the inside of their home. They didn't choose
this. Right.
Now it's part of the pie. I can say camera on at any point. And some kids are sluggish about it. And I press it when we're having discussion, flip it on. The rest of the time, whatever. But you have no idea, you know, who's there. And so you're right. I don't know if I think of it as 80% entertainment, but there's certainly a different energy that comes with it. Like you definitely present it a little differently than you would in the classroom, for sure.
It is. And I've heard this, or I've said, I don't know. We're teaching. I'm sorry. We're selling a product to people who don't necessarily want to buy the product. It's like, it's gotta be like super engaging. And all of us know, everybody listening to this podcast, if you're teaching or in education, you know, engagement is huge. And then you factor in the online piece. I mean, Ryan, do you feel like has that been a struggle? I mean, now that it sounds like you have to have the camera on. So that does help somewhat, I guess.
Well, I mean, you know, that's been a work in progress. And the thing is, we hit some bumps in the road early because originally the plan was just do grade 6 through 12. And they were not going to offer any significant special education services, essentially to like roll it out slowly. Let's make this work.
Right.
And then lawyers got all freaked out and they're like, well, you can't offer this and not offer blank. You know, and I'm like, well, you know, I could go either way. So I'm like, yeah, you choose it, you know, whatever.
The special ed teacher right now is red flags waving.
Yeah, well, so now we
the
have.
The administrator in me is like, oh, no.
Well, the thing is, you know, so we ended up and enrollment was, I think, lower than a lot of people expected. Like, we're okay, but it ended up, the program ended up being K through 12. And with special education services, our county averages somewhere around like 11% of students in special education, 11-12%. We're at like 20-21% in this program.
Whoa.
I think, you know, it varies widely by school, but we have a few, we have a few schools in the county that have a significant ELL population. We have some that have almost none. And we are, again, about 8%, 7-8% above the county average. Now, that average is misleading, though, because you have some schools with a high number and some with none. But take that average and we're, you know, on top of that. And so those pieces make it tricky. And, you know, for me, where I have mostly juniors and seniors, you know, they got into distance learning sort of by force. And, you know, about half of them chose it and about half of them, their parents chose it for them, which is tricky. So I don't mess with the camera thing too much. Like if we're having a discussion, if you're doing a presentation, let's do it. If I'm, you know, yapping at you, getting you some basic information before you go do a little work or do some reading, you know, I don't care. I could talk to myself all day. So sometimes that's just what I have to do. But yeah, I mean, the presentation piece is different. The engagement's different. I mean, Ben, to your point, I always say that teaching, you know, you're doing basically four jobs, and it's like, I'm 25% mm-hmm. content expert. I'm 25% salesman. I'm 25% actor entertainer and 25% counselor. And on any given day, each of those categories has to go up and down, you know, like the, right. You know, your strengths and weaknesses in a character in a video game, you know, some days I need more of this and this, online that the ratios end up being different than like, mm-hmm. you say, oh, I've taught this lesson before for the last 2 or 3 years in person. Now I'm doing it online and I realize like I have to present it differently. So first right. I have the burden of creating, you know, making sure that the materials are digitally functional. I have to get everything into the learning management system. You can't just rely on speaking the instructions. Everything has to be written mm-hmm. out, you know? And so now everything's mm-hmm. written out and I have to explain it, all the rest. So it's all that time of the creation, the posting, everything else. And then we get to class. I have to essentially, you know, sell it a little bit differently than, mm-hmm. than maybe I would otherwise. But I don't know, like I said, I mean, I just, it's kind of a fun challenge, you know, that for every piece of it that I don't like, there's at least one and sometimes two that I do like. And I have to keep reminding myself that in certain ways, it's like being a new teacher again, because I can't just walk in and do it. You know, that's the benefit of experience. You can just show up and do it. You don't have to prepare as much. I mean, you should prepare as much. I should be clear, but you don't necessarily need to in the ways you do in your first couple years teaching. Right. And now like, it's not a thing that I get to, you know, decide how much or how little goes in. Like right. every day you got to be ready like that. And that's probably the hardest part.
Well, and for you, you chose it, but I remember having this discussion, Kyle, and I think you and I talked about this. I had this discussion with my staff, and then when we were full DL for a little bit and then we came back, but I had a group of teachers who taught DL and they're veteran teachers. And they were like, oh my God. And I go, it's like you're a first year teacher. It's okay. It's okay. But when you're like a 17 year vet, that is like their brains were like, I don't understand. I mean, they made it through and they did an amazing job, but yeah, I mean that first year teacher thing, I think that's spot on. I think for a lot of people.
Now, Ryan, do you find it different between before when it was, you have to do this, everybody's in this situation, versus students that are either choosing it or their parents are choosing it? Do you find it easier now than you did before, or about the same? So like tell us a little bit about your experiences with both and just kind of make the comparison.
I mean, it's a little bit different just because you have the ability to say that you chose it. And I don't like to lean on that. You know, it's the same, like you can say the same thing teaching an AP class, you know, kid complains about it. You know, at any given point, I can just be like, look, buddy, you chose this. You could have taken a regular level class, like you chose it. I try not to say that because that it turns confrontational. That's not like a productive discussion often. Once in a while, a kid needs to hear that because they forget that they chose that challenge. And so sometimes that is appropriate, but not too often. And I feel like this is very similar. You know, you chose this, or your parents chose it for you and thought this was going to work. I'm certainly not going to, you know, like punish you for that. I want you to like this. You know, that's the other thing you got to think about with this now that it's choice. You know, before we were all distance learning, and then partway through the school year last year, it was beginning of March, we went to the concurrent hybrid, you know, and so we had students in class and we had, you know, most students stayed home. And that was, you know, it was tricky, but again, you know, it's like, well, you have a choice here, right? And so now I have to sort of remind myself, you know, yes, they chose the program, but I also have to make sure that this is working, it's engaging, that we're going to get good results, because I want the program to live, you know. And if it goes poorly, you know, no one comes back next year, and then it's over, you know. And so that was actually one of my things I was most nervous about, was like, what are the quality of the other teachers in this program? Because I could show up and do a great job. If we don't have a good staff and we don't really connect with these students well, the program, you know, fails, and that could be on us. And so I think that there's a greater awareness of sort of, I mean, it's almost like customer service, you know, which is something you hear from people who teach in private schools. You know, people have the ability to walk away, and you have to know that. And so some of those conversations go a little differently, but I think overall the engagement is a little bit better than we had last year. You know, and it varies class to class too. And that's the other thing, just like, you know, in the building, oh, hey, this class is this way and this class is this way. Like I have an like academic, like on level 11th grade class with like, I don't know, 18 kids, which is a little small. I mean, most of my classes the last few years average, like say 23 to 25, yeah, but 18 and they're pretty good and it goes okay. I have an AP Lit class with four kids in it. I just, cause like not a lot of those kids chose distance. And that is like pulling teeth. Like that one, it's tough, you know? And I give them trouble. I'm like, hey, what do you guys want to read? And they're like, I don't know, whatever. What do you think's good? And I'm like, all right, well here, let's do this. And they're like, okay. And then they do it and they do it and they do good work.
Right.
And I'm like, all right, let's do discussion. And they just sort of stare at each other. They talk a little bit. And I'm like, ah, like I really don't want to hit you guys with worksheet after worksheet.
Right.
But if you don't talk to each other, I have to get you to think about this one way or another, you know? And so like, I'm now planning for a second market period. I'm like, they're going to make a movie. Like we got to do something to stir it up, which is a challenge you can face in person, but it presents itself completely differently online because there's no physical presence. You can't walk up and joke around, you know, like everything is through the screen. And I mean, you know, you're doing these conversations. This is a nice casual conversation, but it's not exactly like it would be if we were all sitting around a table in person. Right. And so you always have to account for that.
And do you talk when, like, and I know, like, we can get into this. I would love to ask about, you know, your podcast and some other things, but I'm curious about, do you feel that there's certain content areas that transfer better to this format? Because I'm thinking about I'm thinking about English. I mean, I'm just curious if, like I could see science would be really hard. I don't know. When you talk to people, do you get that feeling?
I don't know. For the people who I know, and know well enough to talk to, I don't know that they, like, we have a frame of reference, you know, because think about it, like, you can walk in, you know, you can walk down the hall and hear what's going on in other classes with distance. Right. I mean, I have the Google Meet link. I could pop into anyone's class. I probably wouldn't do that and surprise them. At least not. I mean, like in person, you know, I'll be walking by and hear somebody say something funny or notice like, oh, they're in transition. There's a little dead time. I'll just like poke my head in and say something funny, mess the kid and, you know, walk out.
Yeah.
You can't really do that online, you know? And so it's hard because I think we have, in one way, it's like we have less awareness about what's going on in other classes and other subject areas. But, you know, and I would like to check other people's stuff out. But as we said, the planning and the prep is so complex. It's going to be next year or at least the end of this year before I feel like I have the time to do that. I think some classes are absolutely going to be harder online. Like we have a great adaptive PE teacher who works with the elementary kids. He does. I hear he does amazing stuff and the kids all like do it. And I'm like, I don't know how you do that, man. You know, and then I think about like people who are doing chemistry and things like that. And I just think like this is the right time for people to start writing grant proposals because we need to get some virtual reality headsets to these kids so you can do virtual labs. I mean, that technology exists. But you know, we're probably a few years as a program, you know, we're a few years away from even pretending like we're going to be able to do that. But that's my vision for it. My vision for it is essentially that, you know, you kind of just get something that works, you know, keep the kids happy, make sure we're getting decent results. And over the next couple of years, as we all figure out what we're doing, we figure out what our options are to look for some of those innovative strategies to really make this, in my opinion, it should be different than regular school. And the way it was, it's being presented is we're doing essentially as close to regular school as we can online, which I get. And I understand why they do it. But I think in the long term, I don't know that that's a winning game plan. So I understand, you know, we're still in a pandemic. People still have health concerns, but you know, another year, 2 years from now, I think that what we should be doing is a little bit different, you know, maybe a lot different in some cases, but it takes a while to get there. You know, it's that whole, hey, you're a first year teacher. You got a million ideas. The problem is you don't have anything you're ready to do yet. And so some of those ideas have to, you know, you got to bank them for a later date. And that's kind of where I am right now. I have a notebook where I'm like, oh, next year, maybe I'll try. And hopefully I get to some of that, you know?
Well, I can vouch that, at least in my experience, the math does not translate well online. So just because seeing it on the screen in Google Slides, PowerPoint format, Pear Deck format, whatever it may be, is not the same as being able to supplement by writing on the board. Or in my classroom with my co-teacher, we actually have whiteboards taped to the table where the kids can work problems out with marker boards right on the table instead of having to do it in a notebook or whatever it may be. So, but at the same time though, we're still struggling this year because Ben and I have talked about this where a lot of kids, they just forgot how to do school. We're just the whole focusing.
Stamina.
Yeah. Stamina focus where, you know, a kid asked to go to the restroom and what before the pandemic was a 2 to 3 minute thing is now a 20 minute thing, because it's not that they're out causing problems. It's like, they just don't have the stamina to stick around.
How do some of these kids have IBS all of a sudden? Like they're all, they're all having problems. What? My bathroom pass is just like a bottle of Pepto, like take it with you and get back.
And there's no fault there. I mean, it's not like, I don't blame or judge a kid by any means, because I, frankly, I probably would be the same way. And I'm one of the fortunate ones that I have a co-teacher I'm with all day, every day, where if one of us just needs to get out for a minute, we do. We leave for 5-10 minutes and just get away for a minute, because we're having the same issue with the stamina too. So, I mean, I can't pass judgment on a kid because of that. So,
right.
But
actually, I have a question for you guys, because you're both in the school, right? And so I was just talking with a friend about this, and I don't know, it might've been someone, I've had the conversation a couple of times. It might've been on my podcast. I don't know. But I'm hearing more talk this year about stress, about burnout, about quote unquote, the hardest year ever, even more than last year. And last year it made tons of sense to me, because now like I'm doing all the distance learning stuff. I'm like, there's so much prep time and the connection with kids are different. And some people really like really need that in-person thing. And I get that. But like for me, I don't feel it as much. Like I'm tired because I'm doing all this. Like I work at night a lot. And for 1 year, I'm putting in that time for free. And then next year, like I need to be, you know, have that stuff to go to. But I feel like there's this combination of, like you said, people are wearing out. Like it's just, there's this physical exhaustion, or the kids aren't ready. I'm curious though, because I think part of it might be how many people thought that things were changing or going to change. Like the pandemic seemed like this opportunity for innovation. And then as quick as we could, everybody was like, quick, get back into school, get back to normal.
Ding,
so how ding, much of this ding. Is like we're just tired because we're all getting used to it again and the kids need extra help versus how much of this is that people in the back of their mind somewhere they're not recognizing feel a little disappointed and deflated that we went through all this potential change and now we're back to normal? Like is and I'm not in the building, so I don't know. Is that reasonable?
No, I that is a great point. That is something actually that I was thinking about as you're talking through this. Like, and Kyle, we've talked about this, like this was this big paradigm shift that we're all going to move to more options for kids and more like, and for multiple reasons. And I don't fault. I mean, I clearly like I'm in a building, and let me tell you, I had four teachers doing DL. I had one teacher who was teaching a 4-5 comp, like teaching both grades, and she had 56 kids. And I'm like, I just need her not to quit. Like, I'm like, she's one of my most amazing teachers. And like she made it the full year, and I was like, whatever you need, you got it. And now she's back in the classroom teaching just fourth grade. And so for like, I think that there was some of that, like I do think you're onto something. Cause I do wonder like if we all thought, okay, well, this is going to be this paradigm shift. And then now we're back. And I think people are, I think it's that, or I think people think, oh, we should just get back to normal. Well, there is no more normal. There's no more like when this ends, like I had this conversation with someone, I'm like, this is it. This is normal now. Like there's no going backwards. So I think there's some of that. I also think there's a general whatever's out in the atmosphere, the ether of like people in general are just done. Like we know, Kyle and I talked about this on the last one we did, like the number of like incidents with kids getting in fights at school. Like we all read about like adults just behaving poorly at board meetings, at coming to schools.
Had a lot of that just, around here.
Yeah. I mean, it's like that in my district. And so I think that there's some of that too. I think just people are like tired, a general tired, but I love that idea of like, I think you're onto something. Cause I think people did think this is the true paradigm shift. I mean, I was one of those people. I'm like, this is it. We've been talking about a change in education. We're ready for it. And now I kind of feel like.
Yeah. Everybody had the ability to make that happen. We're like, all of a sudden there was some pressure and they're like, and we're going to get back to normal as quickly as we can. And it's not to say that everything we were doing is bad, but we had this big opportunity. And I think a lot of it maybe sort of slipped through our fingers. But again, like I'm in the position where I was feeling a little stir crazy and I found a way to keep my job, but do a new job. So for me, everything I'm doing is new, or at least the way I'm presenting it is new. Right. And so I don't feel that, but when I talk to friends who are in the building, you know, friends who I worked with for years and know very closely, like they're trying to, they can't like put their finger on what's bothering them, but there's something. And it's not just the kids are a little squirrely. It's not just that they're tired or, you know, they miss their elastic waist pants. I mean, that's part of it, but there's like, there's something else sort of floating around. And I don't know, but there's frustration. Kyle, there's frustration in a lot of places.
Well, I mean, it's hard to make a reference because even though it's only been almost 2 years, and that sounds ridiculous just saying that, but that almost 2 years ago feels like a lifetime ago. So it's hard to think back to what it was like before, but I truly do feel like this is the hardest I've ever worked in regards to just the simple stuff, the walking around the room and telling kids, hey, what are you doing right now? This is what we're doing. Let's get back on task. I don't feel like I ever had to tell kids that often about getting on task or, you know, trying to refocus them on things. Because again, it goes back to that fatigue and that stamina of school where kids just are, they're struggling with it right now. And I'm doing a lot of redirecting. And then as a special ed teacher, I'm working with students that didn't get true services for a year and a half, almost 2 years, if you really boil it down to that. So kids with IEPs are, I mean, everybody's behind in some way. I don't want to say learning loss because I hate that phrase, but kids are behind in different ways. But especially my kids with IEPs or kids that are English language learners, they're definitely behind because they didn't have that interaction like they once did. So, and then in regards to my IEP writing, I'm spending a lot more time with that because these are kids, they hadn't been tested or truly evaluated in a long time either. So I do truly feel like I'm working a lot harder than I ever have. And I was just actually talking earlier today with somebody about how tired we are and how I feel right now in the beginning of November, as we're recording this, how I usually feel in about mid-March.
March is a bad feeling.
At that stretch where it's like it's that time between winter break and spring break where you look at it, you're like, oh, there's just, when is this going to end, you know? And then you get that spring break and you feel rejuvenated for a couple 3 weeks, and then you're like, oh wait, when is summer break now? So, and that sounds so awful to say because, you know, people that love their job shouldn't be like looking forward to the end, but right now I got a 4-day weekend for Veterans Day coming up, and man, I am looking forward to that 4-day weekend. I truly am. And I don't plan on doing anything other than playing hockey and watching football during that weekend.
Well, and we've talked about this, and I know Ryan, you're in a different situation, but I think it still applies to where you are too. I think one of the hopes that I had with this, as we moved out of this, not just an educational shift and things like that, but I think we as professionals, teachers, educators are their own worst enemies. I mean, like the joke, we talked about this, a group of principals that I'm with, we're reading Dare to Lead by Brené Brown. And she talks about this whole idea of like we incentivize the people who work beyond their time. Like, oh, you know, that person, they're there till 9 o'clock at night. They work on the weekends. And it's like, whoa, that is the wrong message to send to people. And I'm hoping that people are like, you know what, I got to take time for myself. I have to like, it's not, don't feel guilty about that. I think people are like, hey, if you're tired, take time. And one of the benefits, and my teachers know this, like we're very strict on certain protocols. If you're sick, because we don't know why, I can't ask you to get tested. But if you tell me you're sick, I'm like, get out. You have to leave. Like, and so I have more teachers taking sick days, and then they feel like guilty about that. And I'm like, no, don't feel guilty about that. It's not a badge of honor. And I understand that as somebody who's worked for a long time, I'm like, I have a million sick days, but I'm like, you have to take time for yourself. Like, it's okay to turn your phone off and not respond to people. And I do this myself. I don't respond to, I know I have certain teachers that if I email you at 9 o'clock, you respond to me, and I'm like, okay, well, we're getting in a weird cycle here where like we shouldn't be doing this. But I think people are like, I want people to take a break. And I think that's also part of it. I'm hoping that something that comes out of this is people go, okay, I just need time off. So Kyle, to your point, I don't think people should feel guilty about that at all. I think people need to rest.
No, I absolutely agree.
And Ryan, I mean, in your position, you chose for a reason to do a position, like, clearly because you're passionate about what you do, but also you have little kids at home. And I'm curious, I mean, do you think if the pandemic wouldn't have happened, would you have made that choice?
If I hadn't already done distance learning by force, I would not have chosen distance learning. But even without kids at home, I mean, that's part of it. You know, my son just started kindergarten. So, like, my school day ends and literally his scheduled bus drop off is 2 minutes later. I finish class. I run upstairs out the front door, get him off the bus, do it. We hang out for a little bit. And I do a lot of tutoring, especially in the fall. I do a lot of college admissions essay work. And so, and now I do all that online. So we hang out, you know, get him home, wash your hands, you know, get a little snack. And I'm like, and you get to watch two Pokemon shows while I go down and tutor for another hour. Whereas if I was still in person, you know, I would be in person teaching all day, and then I would be going to the public library, you know, like I used to do. And so there's a lot of good stuff that came with it. But, you know, I have the opportunity for more like downtime. I don't always take advantage of it. You know, like that whole, you know, not being there till nine, you know, it shouldn't be a badge of honor. Like, I get that. I also, you know, I've mentored some new teachers and I tell them, like, in your first year, your first maybe 2 or 3 years, if you can, you stay late, because the better you do early, the easier it is to keep doing well later. Like, make it right the first time. Like, people are like, oh, just get something that's good enough and you'll make it better next year. No, you won't. You're going to use what you have because you're going to be worried about something else. So if it takes you an extra half hour to do it right the first time, do it right, so that next year you don't have the burden of feeling like, oh, now I'm 2 years in and I feel like I'm using subpar materials. Make it the absolute best you can the first time. I mean, you know, don't eat into family time, whatever, but if you're 22, 23 years old, I used to be on a first name basis with most of the custodians, just because I would be 3 or 4 nights a week. I would be there until 8 or 9, and I'd go out, I'd meet up with friends, we'd do whatever. I'm a better teacher for it, but I shouldn't be doing that for an entire career. You know, that's not a reasonable expectation. No one should ask those teachers to do it. I just, when they say, what's a good way to spend my time? I just tell them, before you're married, before you have kids, before you have all this stuff, do it now, you know? But yeah, I mean, I don't think that it's healthy necessarily. You know, this year I chose to essentially be a first year teacher again. So my kids go to bed 8:30, 9 o'clock. My wife's pregnant, so she goes to bed 9:30. So I hang out, and when everybody goes to bed, I go and I do some more work. And it's because this is when I can get stuff done that doesn't need into family time, which is why I said, as long as this program runs for a few years, this is a great decision. If I do all this extra work for 1 year and the program folds, this was a terrible, terrible decision because I'm doing that extra work again. But I don't know. I mean, you know, and part of it is you have to feel good about it. Like, if you're doing all that extra work just to get close to the same productivity you used to expect, like, that's defeating. Like, I'm doing something new, so I know it's more work.
Right.
If I was doing my regular job back in the regular classroom and it was taking me an extra 2 hours a day to somehow get through it, and like, I would not be happy about that. That's for sure. You know? So the time is tough. You know,
that's a good point though. Yeah, that's a good point. I have a brand new teacher. This is her second week. She's finishing her internship while she teaches for me. And I know she's like super eager, and like, yeah, there's been, I drive, cause I live right by my school, and I drive by and I'm like, and there's her car. But then it is, yeah, you're right. It's your first year teaching, you know, I mean, you have to like, almost, I hate to say this, it sounds horrible, you kind of got to pay your dues. It's when I see someone who's like a 20-year vet, and maybe there's a reason they're there, whatever. Like, some people like that. Some people, that's their happy space. I don't know. That's a hard part.
It's no one should ask you to do it. You know, it's not part of the job. If you want to do it, you know, you do it, and that's fine. But it's a difficult balance, because I think we all know that we have a job that cannot be done well within the time we're actually paid for, you know, and that's one of my biggest complaints, is anytime we do something new, you know, I'm happy to play along, but you have to take away something old, and we don't do that very well. You know, it's just easy example, email. Think about how many emails you read or write or think about writing, you know, throughout a day. And then, you know, I mean, I don't know how long you guys have been teaching, but I think back to my high school teachers in the 90s, and they didn't have to answer emails. If they were going to get contacted by someone, it's because they walked to the office and checked the mailbox and saw if there was a note, or someone walked by the room. Right. You know how much time I spend every day answering emails? And you know what didn't happen? Everybody says, well, we've got to have good communication. Post this so that parents can see it. Keep your online grade book up to date. You know, think about back when everybody had paper grade books. I'm not saying that posting it's bad. More information in most cases is good. No. But think about how much extra time it takes. And then the expectation is when a parent writes an email, they want a response within 24 hours or 48 hours. When you have an assignment, you know, oh, the policy is you have 5 days to get that in the grade book. Well, that's cool. But when all those new policies came into place, you didn't give me a single thing that I didn't have to do anymore. And so it piles up in ways that start to feel unreasonable. And I think that's even regardless of pandemic, I think that's the thing that a lot of teachers get frustrated about is that, you know, we add those things without taking things away, which is why good, you know, for, I mean, you know, you guys are into some ed tech and all this kind of stuff. When you think about the best salespeople coming in to deliver, you know, a new product, a new service, a new app, whatever it is, the best salespeople focus when they talk to the teachers, they focus on how much time it'll save them. That's the only thing teachers want to hear. Does it work? And will it save me time? And if they can say, look how easy it is to use, look how the kids like it, and it'll save you time. And all the teachers go, cool, sign me up. Whether it's true or not, you know, that's, and why do we bite on that? Why do we take the bait so easily? Because that's something that we don't have. Like we don't have a good balance of that sort of time that's required to actually do all the different responsibilities well.
Now, because you don't have enough going on, you also host the ClassCast podcast. So talk to us a little bit about your show. What is that about? Like, what kind of conversation do you have with that?
I mean, you know, so it's a little bit of everything, you know. I mean, that's I like to think about the big questions. So, you know, I always ask everybody, what's the purpose of education or what's the purpose of school? You know, school and education are not necessarily the same thing. And so depending on the guest, I'll vary that. I like to ask people, like, what's your ideal school? Like, if you could create your own structure, things like that. Sort of think big about what is it we're trying to do and what are the best ways to do it. But I've talked to everybody. I've talked to former students. I would love to talk to current students, but it seems a little dicey. You know, you still go to school where I work. And I've talked to friends who work elsewhere, and they're like, I'd love to refer students, but you can never let anyone know that I sent them to you. I'm like, no, it's not worth it. You know, just tell them to hit me up when they graduate. But I talk to former students. I talk to teachers. I talk to, you know, entrepreneurs, school board members, people who work in charities, you name it. It's just, my general belief is that, you know, public education is an important thing that we do and that it's not a thing that we will ever do perfectly. So any person in the community has the potential to have useful input on what we're doing. You know, that's that whole thing. You know, lately we say, oh, we want parents more involved in the kids' education. And then the parents show up and start yelling at the school board. We're like, hold on, never mind. We want less parent input. Like, everybody take a deep breath. Well, you know, no, like we do want everyone to have the input, but we also want people to be like calm and purposeful and recognize that we all have the same or very similar goals. And, you know, and you got to remember it's kind of a same team kind of thing. And when the conversation strays from that, it gets ugly, as we've seen. But so I sort of cut kind of a wide path through education, which in some ways makes for really interesting discussions. One of the downside of that, though, is that I have an episode that'll get hundreds of listens, and then the next one gets like, you know, 80. And it's just because the guests are very different. So even though the style of the conversation is similar, we're thinking big picture, what are we trying to do? What works? You know, what are things we should try? You know, and a lot of it's sort of on the philosophical level. It varies a lot, like both the conversations, but also my actual like statistics, the numbers, they're everywhere. And I never know. My rule is, as long as when the conversation's done, I feel like I learned something and had a good time, I liked the person I talked to, then that was a good episode for me. I would love big numbers, but you know, as long as I feel, hey, I learned something and that was fun, I'm cool. But yeah, it's a little bit everything. And so, you know, I'm about to release my 80th episode next week. So it's going, you know, you guys are out ahead of me by about a year, maybe a little more than that. But I like to talk a lot, as you can hear. So it's a nice way to channel that energy.
Yeah, you have a lot of similarities with Ben and I in all those regards.
Yes.
So I'm assuming we can find that wherever you find podcasts. But where else can listeners connect with you? Social media, websites, anything of that nature?
Yeah. So, the ClassCast podcast streams everywhere and on YouTube. But you can find me on Twitter at ClassCastPod and on Facebook and Instagram at ClassCastPodcast. And the website is ClassCastPodcast.com.
Outstanding. So, well, Ryan, thank you so much for this enlightening conversation. This has been an absolute delight for the almost hour we've been at this already, but we're not done yet. We do got a few more things to do. So, but again, we can't thank you enough for joining us.
Cool, yeah. Man, thank you, Ryan. It's awesome.
Awesome.
Awesome to have you.
So listeners, as always, if you would like to keep this conversation going, share some of your thoughts on today's topics, you can email us at info@beeredupodcast.com. Tweet us using hashtag beeredupod. That handle is at beeredupod. And that is the same thing for Instagram. You can hit us up on Facebook at beeredupodcast. That's all one word. Subscribe to our YouTube channel at bit.ly/beeredu YouTube. Make sure, again, you're following Ryan on Twitter at ClassCastPod and all the other channels that he provided. You can send us a voice message using the Anchor app if you'd like. You could also leave us a review. We would love that wherever you're listening so more people can find the podcast. And Ben, guests that want to come on the podcast, what do they have to do?
Yes. So you just need to go to our website, beeredupodcast.com. You click on that contact and subscription info link. Fill out that guest form, get in the queue. We would love to have you on, talk about what you are passionate about in education, share your beer. If you don't drink beer, share whatever you like to drink with us. And with that, we have to make sure we thank some people. We have to thank School Rubric for featuring the Beer Edu podcast. Again, the mission of School Rubric is to help schools, educators, parents, and students tell their stories so that stakeholders can make the best choices about enrollment and staffing. So check out schoolrubric.com and find more great content from educators all over the world. And then we are also part of the Codebreaker podcast network. So you can find the Beer Edu podcast over on codebreakeredu.com. You can also find so many other great podcasts like Staff Room Podcast, STEM Every Day, Teachers on Fire, My EdTech Life. Check them out at codebreakeredu.com. And Ryan, this is the part where Kyle is going to do a little teaching right now. And Kyle, you kind of went down a rabbit hole here. Like we talked before we started about how you started one place and you ended up someplace else.
Yeah, just kind of like I usually do these things. I end up down rabbit holes. So, you know, ahead of time looking to see that Ryan's from Northern Virginia, I thought, you know what? I've heard these stories. I've read these things about George Washington and brewing at Mount Vernon and how he was a beer guy, so on and so forth. So I thought, let's look at George Washington brewing. Well, then I couldn't really find any like real good sources out there that really told a good story about it. But in the process, I found out that he had created a recipe back in the 1750s for what is called small beer. And I'm like, wait a second, what is small beer? So what I found out was it's sometimes also referred to as table beer. And this is something I had heard of before, and I know I've had some before. This is a beer that is lower in alcohol content than traditional beer, usually between 0.5% to 2.5% is all. Oh. So very low ABV beer. This was something that was popular in medieval Europe and colonial America. And a lot of times it was produced for consumption by servants and children. Which sounds awful because why would we want children drinking beer? It was much cheaper to produce than regular beer. And it was also, though, especially for the children part, it was a safer alternative to drinking water.
Because I was just going to say, water wasn't clean.
No, you could die from drinking water, but they didn't know why beer was cleaner. They just knew it was. So everybody was drinking beer. So now the nice thing about small beer, because it's so low in ABV, you can drink a lot of this and not get drunk. So workers, they would put down like 10 pints of this stuff a day. No effect because it's so low in ABV. Also, you had the nutritious value from it. So you had, it's made from grain. There's caloric intake when you're drinking beer. And then a lot of these table beers or these small beers often had suspended grain that wasn't filtered out. Some of them so thick, it had actually like a porridge-like texture. Not sure how much I want to drink a beer that's porridge-like, but hey, if that's your one meal for the day, I guess you got to do what you got to do. So now, like I mentioned, it was cheaper to produce than regular beer. And then especially in early like England, it wasn't taxed as much as regular beer. So, but eventually what happened was brewers were trying to get around paying the tax on the beer. So they were mixing table beer or small beer with regular beer and saying, oh, this is just small beer. So we only have to pay X amount. So they finally just got rid of that because, no, you're defrauding the British government out of money at this point. So, and we know how much the Brits loved taxes back in the day.
We know what that led to.
Yeah, eventually. So now, eventually, though, small beer kind of fell out of favor and was replaced by tea. in England and the Commonwealth. So we think of like the Brits as being tea drinkers. And this is part of the reason why, because eventually it replaced table beer. So now today you can make beer, small beer, just like a regular batch of beer. But the thing I found interesting was that sometimes it's made as a second run. So what they'll do is they will brew a batch of beer, then take all the liquid off. You have the mash left over, which normally you just discard. You can actually water it up again and brew a second batch. And because the fermentable sugars have basically all been spent from the previous regular batch, you're going to get a less ABV batch from that. So, but still have a similar taste profile because obviously of the mash and the hops and everything. So now this was, again, very common in colonial America. I mentioned George Washington. He had a recipe for small beer that he wrote back in the 1750s. He brewed for a short time, but later on, he had other people do the brewing for him or just purchased it. From what I found, he actually spent a lot of money on beer for his campaigns when he was running for like House of Burgesses and other political positions. That was his campaign budget, was to buy beer for the people he was visiting with. And then he also had beer at Mount Vernon for his servants and enslaved peoples that were there. Ben Franklin, in his autobiography, claimed that he had small beer with his breakfast on a regular basis. So,
well, there you go.
Yeah, so he was drinking that with his breakfast on a regular basis. Now, this isn't one that's common, obviously. I mean, I'd heard of table beer, not small beer.
Right.
Obviously, I'd never heard of it. Nowadays, small beer, it's upwards of like 4% ABV, not like 2.5%. A lot of times it's like the style of a Saison. So like think down like a really watered, not, I don't want to say watered down, but a much lower version of a Saison. So check your local brewery or beer store. You might be able to find it. It's kind of a lawnmower beer because it's real light.
Well, I think that is the lawnmower beer. Do you, so I'm trying to think, I've never seen it. Like now, because I'm thinking like there's a new thing with like Athletic Brewing. We've talked about this. Like there's a bunch of companies now doing, they're really trying to target the non-alcoholic but beer profile. And those, but that's different because those are down in the 0.2 or something like that. Right, so we're talking about like a
4%. A non-alc versus a small beer are definitely different because again, you can have these like 2, 3, maybe even 4%. But again, they're not going to be super, you know, heavy like other beers. So,
and Ryan just like the, do apples tie into this? Like, because a cider is similar to a beer. It's just using different.
Yeah, you just don't. You're not using grain. You're using apples as the ferment, the way to get the fermentable sugars. So you're getting something totally different. So now I don't know how much of a connection there is really to that because, you know, ciders typically are lower in the ABV as well. Right. So I'm not 100% sure, but no, I just, this was an interesting rabbit hole I fell down.
And it's funny you said that because I've been thinking about brewing some beer again and you know, an excuse, basically it's an excuse to go to the brewery store and buy a bunch of new stuff to just play with. But then I'm like, then I could do two batches. And then that would be interesting to do.
You could do a heavy duty IPA and then you could make a smaller, like sessionable style one by doing a second run.
Yeah, because that's always the problem. When you brew beer and you have a bunch of beer in your fridge, you drink a bunch of beer. I mean, it's not really it's a horrible problem to have. I get it. It's a first world problem. But I mean, I'm like, yeah, that's interesting. That's cool. I've never heard of that. See, there we go. I
barely knew about it. So join the club. So. But that being said, though, that does put a wrap on episode 115.
Yeah, it does. Ryan, thank you so much for being on the show. It was amazing to talk to you.
Thanks for having me, guys.
Absolutely. And listeners, thank you as always for joining us. And until next time, may the malt and the hops.
Right on.